It's time to get nerdy, y'all.
A little bit of gaming history for you.
Something relevant in gaming and discuss our opinions on it.
Should we kick it out of here or should we kickstart it?
This is the part where you, the listeners, try to stump the hosts.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast. Hello and welcome, everybody. It is Tuesday, December 22nd, 2020, which means it's time to get nerdy. Welcome to episode 169 of Two Nerds in a Pod, the nerdiest gaming podcast in the multiverse. Your two hosts are myself, Maxion, tech enthusiast, and my good friend and comrade in gaming commentary, Mr. Lom Galuka, also known as Mr. Nice Guy, and our one-hour mission is to bring you news, history, issues, crowdfunding, trivia, and lawsuits that are important to video games. Our returning sponsor this week is Game Insider Magazine. Thanks, you guys. And Mr. Nice Guy, how are you, sir?
Dude, I'm phenomenal. It's Christmas week. There is no snow on the ground in Illinois, which I have mixed feelings about, but I'm okay with it. Now, one thing I want to point out real quick. If you look to my left, you'll notice I have, as always, one of the greatest inventions of all time, the Valve Index. And I always have a retro console next to me. This week, I put my homie of the past 6 years, the PlayStation 4, next to me. And the reason why is because it's getting retired as the PlayStation 5 has come out. And I did snag one, and it will be open on Christmas Day. So I just wanted to give a shout-out real quick to the PlayStation 4. It's one of the greatest consoles in terms of software that I've ever experienced in my 25, 30 years as a gamer. So shout out to the PlayStation 4. I got it right next to me. It's going to get retired.
I'm saluting your PlayStation. This is an audio medium, so I need to mention that I'm saluting for a job well done. And, you know, happy retirement, sir. Pension and everything. Best of luck to you in the future endeavors.
That's right. But, Mac, as far as how I'm doing really, really well. Excited to do the pod tonight. Excited to do some fun stuff for the holidays. Keeping it home, keeping it social distanced. But, man, that's pretty much it, dude. How about you? What's up?
Oh, man, you know me. I live a very quiet life with not that much going on. But it is close to Christmas, as you know. And I have a tradition, a history, ever since the first Christmas, which would have been a mere 3 months after we started Retro Gaming Live TV. I guess that would have been back in 2015? Has it been that long? 2016?
It was pretty close to the time I started streaming.
Yeah.
So around then.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. But I had this thing where on Christmas Eve, I would read in front of the fireplace or what, you know, passed for a digital fireplace then, a copy of a Worlds of Power book. So Scholastic made these books for children that were, you know, video game adjacent, and they were all they were all fine. Not quite the worst books ever, you know, but like definitely not good. And so I'd do a reading every Christmas. And so in true fashion, I've been, even though I'm not an active portion of that streaming team any longer, I still keep getting invited back on Christmas Eve to keep up the tradition, and this year will be no different. So, yeah.
That's awesome. So, I don't know if you said a date, and you said the date, obviously.
Yeah, Christmas Eve, Thursday.
What is the time, so people can tune in?
8 Eastern time, so 6 p.m. Mountain. If you want to show up, that's totally cool. I would love to have your things. I won't obviously be interacting with the chat much because I will be reading a Scholastic book.
But one thing you always used to do, and I believe you used to do it on Christmas Day, was like a Mega Man. Or was that Thanksgiving?
That was Thanksgiving. I would do all the classic Mega Mans 1 through 10, and then eventually they added 11. I'd do that in one go on Thanksgiving. This Thanksgiving, though, I was otherwise occupied. So that's just some stuff that's coming up. Although it was, I will say real quick, a fun week since we've been together last. I had some visitors, some friends who came by on their way to someplace else. They crashed for the night and then skedaddled, but it was delightful to have some company. It happens far too infrequently these days.
On that note, I say we do what we do best and hop right into that gaming news, man. What do you think about that?
Let's do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this is episode number 169. Or as the French would say, cent soixante neuf, of Two Nerds in a Pod, the nerdiest video game podcast in the galaxy. And it's a slow news week before Christmas, right? There's just not a ton, but we're going to talk about some things. Let's talk first, Mac. And this one is super, super interesting to me. Nintendo Boss says, and this is on GameSpot.com by Jeremy Winslow, let's just read this. He says, having launched almost 4 years ago, Nintendo of America president Doug Bowser believes the Switch has finally entered the midpoint of its life cycle. That's interesting. In an extensive interview with Polygon, Bowser discussed the company's 2021 outlook, how well the Switch performed amidst the ongoing pandemic, and what the midpoint for both the standard Switch and more affordable Switch Lite means for the platform's ecosystem. There's a quote from him that says, the way we build games onto the platform and the way partners build games onto the platform is really what matters, and the experience that you have when you play, Bowser said. So that's what we'll continue to lean into as we go into really what will be the fifth year of Nintendo Switch. And as Mr. Shuntaro Furukawa, president of Nintendo, mentioned in his corporate management policy briefing, we believe we're just at the midpoint of the life cycle of this platform. So Matt, if we're at the midpoint of the Switch, that's 4 years in, that implies another 4 years of Switch. Do you think that, and I know you don't own the Switch, but I know you have experienced it quite extensively playing Breath of the Wild and other games. Do you think that the Switch is anywhere near needing a refresh like the other consoles?
I mean, it's tough to say because let's acknowledge that when we're talking about console refreshes, we are talking about situations where, for some reason or another, the technical side of things is outpacing what the console can handle. And in a lot of ways, Nintendo did not aim for their console to be structured around outpacing technology. You know what I mean? As opposed to the types of things that Xbox or that Microsoft and PlayStation have been pushing, which has necessitated console refreshes. I don't think Switch at this point in time has reasons to make those kinds of moves. You know.
And I should rephrase, because technically they have had a refresh, because the original Switch has a little bit less battery life than the same model that now comes out. So they've kind of refreshed it. Also, we've gotten the Switch Lite. So when I say refresh, I mean exactly what you referred to, which is like a completely new console. Not a refresh, but a new console. And I agree with you 100% that we don't need one. And there's a couple reasons why. Microsoft really isn't competing with Nintendo isn't really competing with Microsoft and PlayStation and Sony. They didn't even give the Switch 4K capability. You know, the online is not as robust. There's no party chat or group chat system. Nintendo's doing their own thing, and their exclusives, I feel like they are more exclusive than almost any of Microsoft's or Sony's. Like you think video games, you think Mario, right? And Mario does not need to be 120 frames per second for it to be fun, right? It's not about graphical fidelity. It's just about the content. So not to say that like The Last of Us and all that is not about the content as well. But point is, Nintendo drums to their own beat. And so I agree. I don't think we need a new one. And people in the chat seem to agree. We got any comments, Mac, we want to read about this?
Alex, man, very much reflects kind of the things that we've been saying. Nintendo's never wanted to push for power. It was for replacing the big, bulky game console with a tablet that brings stuff on the go. And, you know, it's certainly something that they experimented with in the Wii U, which, of course, had issues.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I'll say this, more so than any of my other consoles, I'm really happy with my Switch. I don't feel like there's anything that needs to be changed about it. And I could play it for another 4 years. I think to hear that it's the midpoint of the life cycle is interesting, though, because that implies a life cycle of 8 years, a lifespan rather of 8 years. And it almost makes me wonder, Mac, do you think it'll be kind of like with the PS2, how it had a 10-year life cycle, but it was overlapped by the release of the PS3? You know, where maybe they'll keep making Switch games, but they'll release like a Switch 2 in 3 years, and the life cycle will continue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it certainly has plenty of precedent. After all, we had games like Wind Waker being released for both the Wii as well as, was it the... I want to say it was the GameCube, and they've definitely done things where they've introduced a new console and kept introducing games. As a matter of fact, I think Just Dance 2020 was released on the Wii.
Was it?
Yeah, I'm 79% sure.
Someone please fact check us on
yes.
that. I'm gonna guess no.
Let us know, but I'm pretty darn sure that it was Just Dance 2020 for the Wii. And I mean, Nintendo has done this. Whichever the overlap was, what we did have was we did have Wind Waker. You know, we did have some of these games where something that straddled the changeover, they released it for both systems. So I could absolutely see them continuing to produce something. Twilight Princess was on the Wii as a launch title. I might be thinking Twilight Princess then, as being on the Wii and on the
yeah.
GameCube.
Yeah, because Twilight Princess disc had that glitch where people could use it to hack the Wii. Like, it was the thing that allowed people to do homebrew titles on the Wii, right? Was putting the Twilight Princess disc in, doing a couple different button presses, and some software hacking, and it allowed people to do that.
If I say yes, will there be no follow-up questions?
I'm 100% sure about this.
Okay.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. So anyway, we've got a few examples. Whether or not we got the consoles correct or I got the consoles correct. Remember, a lot of these consoles I actually skipped over in the past. So go gentle on me. But it is one of those they have certainly proven themselves to be willing to make those kinds of things.
And Buster Rhydon, I think he summarizes it really well. He says, as long as they keep producing Mario, Legend of Zelda, Metroid, etc., I don't care what hardware it's on. We're due for a new Mario Kart. We're definitely due for a Metroid. So that leads me to believe that they could still put out plenty of titles in the second half of this console's life cycle and still have people be happy. Like, we haven't gotten everything that we've come to expect from Nintendo. The one thing I'll say that's interesting about the Switch, and we'll end on this as far as this topic, is the type of software is a little disc. And so it kind of makes it harder for there to be any type of backwards compatibility going forward unless the next console has the same type of software. And I don't know if Nintendo's going to do this again. I could see them going back to disc. So it'll be interesting to see.
I will say before we leave this topic that I did check, and yes, Just Dance 2020 released for the Wii as well as whatever else. So, I mean, you know, we're not without without precedent here. So,
well, cool. Let's move on to some other stuff. This one is interesting, Mac. This is kind of a retro topic. It's about Arcade 1-Up, which I feel like toes the line between retro and modern, right? We've heard of Arcade 1-Up. This is on IGN.com. It says, Tastemakers, the company behind, and it's by Seth Macy. Tastemakers, the company behind Arcade 1-Up's line of 3/4 scale multi-game arcade cabinets, is releasing an additional game for its new Outrun cabinet completely free, Rad Rally. The 1991 sit-down arcade driving game from Sega joins Outrun, Turbo Outrun, Outrunners, and Power Drift, bringing the total games to 5. And representing the first such addition to an Arcade 1-Up cabinet post-reveal. Arcade 1-Up calls it a gift to thank its customers for all the support throughout the year. Now, Mac, I have a couple questions for you. My first question is, what are your thoughts on Arcade 1-Up generally? Are you a purist? Do you hate the fact that these things exist, or are you okay with it?
No, I love the fact that they exist. I just wish they were ever so slightly more affordable. And ever so slightly, like, that I could play with space and time just a little bit more so that I could not just afford it, I could afford one, but also have the place space to put it. You know what I mean? Because I would love multiples of various things. So,
And that's the thing is, like, so here's where I don't get the business model. I feel like people who want these their market is a purist. Their market is someone who wants to play with old school hardware and play those old school ROMs, right? Those old school games in their original form. But yet the package that they're releasing them in is not true to form. It's a 3/4 scale, and sometimes the artwork isn't even the same, and it has multiple games on one cabinet, right? And just listening to different arcade owners on podcasts and things, a lot of them are effectively against MAME because it's not pure. And this is basically a MAME machine, in my opinion. I don't know if you'd agree with that or not.
Well, I would have to know more technical details about it, but I would be surprised if it wasn't MAME. It basically has to be MAME. And I am not in line with those purists. I think MAME is fantastic. I think much in the same way that stuff like my cartridges, my like EverDrives and the like, are a good thing for people who want to play but don't want to drop $500 on a little Samson cart. You know,
yeah.
The opportunity to play without having to invest all of the money, you know, lowering the barriers to entry there if what you want to do is play.
Yeah, and Galvatron says something that I kind of agree with. He says, a friend has an arcade 1UP. I know they are building to a lower price point, but it feels cheap, the monitor is low res, and the stick and buttons feel fragile. So, like, to me, I feel like it's kind of built for kids. Like, if I wanted a Donkey Kong cabinet, I would want a real Donkey Kong cabinet, right? I would want to find a classic one. And put it in my home, you know, one that's in good condition, and it's a piece of history. That, to me, that's what these old school arcade games are about. For Arcade 1UP, it feels like it's built for kids. Like, it's kind of like, hey, I got you this arcade, you know, let's stick it downstairs. You know, it's kind of like something a casual gamer would buy. So I kind of side with the purists in that sense. But Mac, here's the interesting thing about this technology to me. It sounds like they are now able to add games post-release. And if that's the case, I feel like this is a much more appealing business model. And the fact that, like, the NBA Jam one has online play and stuff like that, do you think that that takes away from the purity? The fact that you can play online with friends? You know, because arcades, like, the whole vibe of arcades was, oh, let's go, we got our quarters, you know, side by side. I don't know, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I am very much willing to be like, sure, it wasn't meant to be played online originally, but I mean, how many of those awesome arcade sessions are you having in your basement right now? And also, if my favorite person to play with in the whole wide world is you, Mr. Nice Guy, I don't want to have to wait months and months between times that you can fly out here or I can fly out there in order for us to get our game on. And if it's really about the game, I'm a little bit more permissive with respect to that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when it comes down to fun, these things are fantastic. When it comes down to, like, history, maybe they're not for you. If you're really wanting to own a piece of history, go on Craigslist, go on OfferUp, and find a pure one. Well, we're short on time. Just a couple other cool pieces of info before we wrap this section. Black Panther and waiting for the story to load back up on my iPad. They're coming to Fortnite. It's not loading. But I just wanted to say this is kind of a cool tribute to Chadwick Boseman. I think it's kind of cool how much Fortnite is bringing in outside influences. They somehow managed to secure Master Chief, which is amazing. And now they have Black Panther skins that you can purchase. The last piece of info, and we will not discuss this for lack of time, is the fact that the PlayStation 5 now warns you if you are about to play an older version of their game on PS5. So when you log into your PS5, if you're accidentally about to play the PS4 version of a game and you have the PS5 version as well, it will let you know so that you can make sure you're playing the most updated version if that is what you want. To me, that's a convenience feature that is very innovative and important. Mac, that has been our news for the week.
All right, well, now we will turn our attention back into the past. You know, we talk about a little something called gaming history each week. Now, normally I would have a bunch of games for us to talk about. Oh, here's this game. It came out in 93, and, you know, it had these types of contributions to games. It was the first one with, like, passwords, although that was more like 83 or so, da-da-da-da, and so on. And sometimes that leads to some interesting conversation. Well, as Mr. Nice Guy had said at the start of the show, it's kind of interesting to be in this limbo in December because nobody really wanted to release video games this close to Christmas, because at least not in the North American market, because, you know, there's no time to go out to the store, buy that, bring it home to the kiddies, wrap it under the tree. But yeah, we just don't have that. So instead, I propose that we share with everybody our favorite console of all time and why.
This is tough.
And then we follow it up with our least favorite / most disappointing console and why. And because I wrote this up, I had a few seconds to think about it, so I hope you'll let me go first.
Please, go first. We want to hear from the chat as well.
Okay. So my favorite console, it happens to be the PS1, so the smaller version of the PlayStation.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason why that's my favorite is because it is the first game console that I bought with my own money while it was still on the store shelves. The PS1 for me was just it was mine, my own, my precious. Granted, the, you know, the games were expensive and I barely had enough money to support any of that. If I was lucky, I was able to buy a game every 6 to 8 months. Yeah. Occasionally maybe I would try renting something, but it being the first one that I purchased makes it kind of the console that I feel like defines me. So the PS1, that's why that one's my favorite. Mr. Nice Guy, what about you?
It's so funny that you asked me that today, because I was actually thinking about it today as I was playing a game, and I'll save this for what we've been watching, what we've been playing. But as I was playing a game on SNES Switch Online, I think mine is the SNES. I gotta go with that. I remember getting it for my birthday in like fifth grade and getting Donkey Kong Country and just amazing, right? Just having my mind blown. And I had played it before at friend's house. I had had a blast. But to me, that's the one that I remember spending the summer months playing with my brother. This was in a time where the internet was not really like as prevalent as it is now. And so to find out what games were good, you just had to like ask your friends or just like look at the cover and be like, oh, this looks dope. We're going to get this one. And my first experience buying a game myself with my own money as a kid was Super Mario All-Stars for the Super Nintendo. I remember me and my brother literally going to a Sears driven by my mom or dad and emptying like our piggy bank and counting out the money and buying Super Mario All-Stars, which makes no sense because we had an NES that had most of those games, but we, for whatever reason, we wanted the better graphics. So we bought it, played it, had a blast. I remember Marvel's War of the Gems, Donkey Kong Country 2, still in one of my top 5 games of all time. Oh man, Super Mario World, Separation Anxiety, Spider-Man versus Venom, you know, Mario Kart, like I could go on forever. Aladdin, you know, just so many games. And it was great. And the jump from NES to SNES was so huge. I put so much time into that thing. And it's one of my favorites. It is my favorite of all time.
Well, now, least favorite. Our most disappointing consoles. I'm willing to go first if you need some time to think about it.
Please, I think I know what mine is, but go ahead.
Okay, now, I will say I am limiting myself to just the consoles that I, like, had. So I know that counts out a lot of disappointments like the Wii U or, you know, previously referenced. But for me, of all the video game consoles that I've owned, I think the most disappointing for me was the Nintendo 64.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
And now, to be fair, I come at this from a very different standpoint because I only got a Nintendo 64 in 2016, 2017. And while I have enjoyed some of the games on the Nintendo 64, a good chunk of the library I have found to be just disappointing. There are some great titles on there, and some games that I am genuinely better off for having played. I am thrilled that I have all 120 stars in Super Mario 64. I'm glad that I did all of that. Jet Force Gemini, Perfect Dark. But there comes a point where I feel like I can name five or six, and then there's nowhere else for me to go on the console, because I feel like there's a lot of meh on that console.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Maybe that's my problem, because I came at it so late and my expectations are so much higher. I didn't move forward with it. You know what I mean? But
yeah, Metz Girl just called you out in the chat. She just said GoldenEye. Which,
sure.
I don't get how you could say Perfect Dark and not say GoldenEye, but that's just...
Oh, so. Perfect Dark's better. I feel he's shaking his head. But I feel like of the consoles, that's been the most disappointing. And to be clear, that's still a pretty darn good console for it to be the backside of the pack. Thank goodness I didn't have the Wii U to tag on there. But Mr. Okay. Nice Guy, over to you.
So I've got to defend the N64.
Sure,
for a
defend
minute
the you honor.
You said you could only name like five? Like five games that are good? Like, come on.
Five games that really resonated with me, that I liked, that I would go back and play again, you know?
In your defense as well, no one's making N64 retro graphics, right? Or I should say, like, making games with N64 graphics, because those graphics have aged so poorly. So if you didn't play N64 in its heyday, then yeah, I could see why it's one of your most disappointing. But I mean, I'm going to do this to you real quick. GoldenEye 64. Mario Kart 64, Super Mario 64, Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask.
64.
All of those, yep. Tony Hawk Pro Skater.
64.
Gauntlet Legends.
64.
I mean, that's just seven right there off the top of my head. And I mean, if you didn't like Tony Hawk, then to each their own. My most disappointing has got to be the GameCube. Yeah, and I mean, the GameCube, I feel like it's one of those consoles that maybe it was because I was in college when I was playing it, and I just didn't have the time, but I always found myself playing third-party stuff. Like, I remember that's when I got into Splinter Cell, was on the GameCube, originally. I like Zelda, but I've never really been one to, like, play Zelda and, like, explore and do everything, and so the Zeldas on there weren't really for me. I remember playing, like, NBA 2K on the GameCube, and that's not what it's meant for. I remember playing Killer 7 on the GameCube and just not being able to get into it. It didn't have the best Mario game. I never got into the Metroids. The controller was just not the best unless you were using it for Smash. Then it was that, to me, it was a Smash console, right? It was a console for Super Smash Brothers. And by the way, Super Smash Brothers 64. But yeah, that to me, that's my most disappointing console. I bought a lot of games for it, but just didn't get through them. Maybe it was just where I was in life. I don't know.
Well, I don't think you're going to find that many detractors. Like, I came with the hot takes, and boy, have people let me know it. But I don't see anybody standing up for the GameCube in the same way.
Chat's disagreeing with you.
Oh, yeah, hardcore. And I mean, that's part of the fun. That's why, as we record this podcast, I like, you know, you all to put me on notice for when I'm going crazy. But, you know, thank you for participating. Thank you for letting me know that I was way off base. But, you know, let's be clear. The options, there weren't a lot of options. Something had to be at the back of the pack. But that would be gaming history, or what I have for gaming history, for today, here in December.
Cool. Well, let's keep it moving. Time for the topic of the week, where we talk about something relevant in gaming and give our opinions on it. Mac, this one was cherry-picked for you, my friend. I hope this is not also going to be your legalese discussion. I doubt it. But this is an interesting story. This is by Nathan Grayson on Kotaku. Shout out to Nathan Grayson. I do not know him, but I generally like the articles that he writes and the things he has to say. So I'm excited to share one of his today. An esports team signed an 8-year-old, but nobody is sure if it's legal, is the title of this, Mac. We want to get your take. and the chat's take as well. If nothing else, Team 33 certainly made a splash when it arrived on the esports scene earlier this month. In a press release, the previously unknown organization boasted a Hollywood team house that had already played host to big names like Janelle Monáe, Post Malone, and Drake. Mac, those are all musicians.
Right? I know all of those. Thank you very much. Post Malone, I could take or leave. Janelle Monáe, though. Oh, I have a crush on Janelle Monáe, and Mrs. the Mac does too. So, you know, we both crush on Janelle Monáe. Anyway.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Oh, right. What about Drake? You don't like Drake's music?
No.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Okay.
Sure.
But it wasn't glitz and glamour that prompted a withering glare from the esports community's eye of Sauron. Instead, it was the team's first announced signee, a Fortnite player named Joseph Dean. He is 8 years old. Dean is a child. To hear Team 33 co-founder Tyler Gallagher tell it, he's an extremely skilled child, but a child nonetheless. Despite that fact, Dean is now a full-fledged member of a professional organization, and he's got a $33,000 signing bonus and a brand new $5,000 gaming setup to show for it. When the signing was first announced, some esports fans declared Dean's unlikely debut a dream come true, the sort of opportunity most kids would screech themselves hoarse over. But others looked on with furrowed brow and scrunched up faces. They smelled something fishy. At such a young age, how could he enter tournaments? And what could the team possibly have him do that wouldn't violate child labor laws? Surely, fans figured, Dean's signing couldn't be legal. So, Mac, it probably goes on to give some more facts and maybe some speculation about whether or not it's legal.
Well, if there's anything I like to do, that is give my totally not legal advice without all of the facts.
Well, we can't read the whole article, but we get the gist of where this is going, and we're intelligent enough we can discuss it with that much information. General thoughts before I get into some more specific questions, both from you, Mac, and from the chat.
So, just the general thoughts, of course, is that there are a lot of things that you can do as long as you have a guardian sign up. We are talking about children who have been a part of many different industries, some more exploitative, some less exploitative, in the past. So we need not look all the way back to coal mines. We can look to, I don't know, any number of Hollywood sets that involve child actors. And one of the things that they do is they limit the amount of hours that you can put a child actor to work. One of the reasons why twins are so popular in Hollywood for filming with children is that you can work one of them for 4 hours, swap the other one in for the other 4 hours, and woo, done. So, you know, it's how you can get the most out of your child actors. Just make sure that there is a genetically carbon copy around to use as well. But I've rambled on far long enough. Those are my general thoughts on
children. That was very general, but also kind of specific, if we want to get down to it. No, I appreciate the thoughts, Mac. You said some things I was going to say, which is the film industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kids are allowed to act. The one danger I feel comes with it for a kid is that they can get burned out. We hear a lot of stories about child actors who grow up and they've gone crazy, right? Or, you know, they've flamed out. Frankly, we hear that about adults as well, though. So I don't know if that's a valid argument. This kid is 8 years old and he's really, really good at something. I feel like he should go for it. I mean, these types of things are once in a lifetime opportunities where once you reach a certain age, you know, once you reach, what, 30, they don't want you to be part of an esports team anymore. They think you're too old and you've lost your click speed and your reflex speed and all that. So, I mean, while you're 8, give it a shot. And he's at a point where he can course correct. If he does this for a couple years and says, you know what, I don't like Fortnite anymore, I don't like gaming anymore, he's not so old that he can't do something different. Now, if it was my kid, I don't know how I'd feel. I'd probably feel the same way. I have one son right now who's really, really into Smash Brothers. And he would play it all day if I wouldn't stop him. And I told my wife, I said, you know, he may grow up and he may be a pro Smash Brothers player. Like, he's good enough that he can beat me. And he's 7. So you gotta nurture kids and their talents. You just need to make sure they're protected. And that's the issue that I worry about, Mac, is not the labor, but protecting the kid. Because these esports stars, they do interviews, they go to parties, they're at these public events where, frankly, you have to be 18 to get in. You know, not everyone who is at these gaming events or in these parties is a good person. And so if you're 8, you know, I feel like it's on the esports team to make sure that this kid is protected in a certain sense. It's on the parents, but it's also on the people that have signed him to be part of this team.
I feel, to a certain extent, I'm like, I don't have that much to offer. Not having kids, not having the experience of how it is protecting them from the wild and crazy esports parties.
Not even just the parties, but just being at public events. Being a public a public figure when you're 8 years old is a dangerous thing, I think. It's dangerous when you're an adult.
Yeah.
So, we got a couple comments in the chat. I'll read a couple of them. Galvatron said, I know for a fact that NFL, NBA, MLB, and NHL send scouts to middle school and to scout prospects. Some college sports programs offer scholarships to kids. I responded to him in the chat and said, that's true. But in that sense, they're not being paid. Right? So, if, for example, if someone gets a scholarship to go to college, they are being compensated, but they are not being paid. And the NCAA has been very, very careful about this differentiation because college athletes are not supposed to be paid. In fact, a college athlete who had a YouTube channel that was somewhat successful was told that he had to shut it down if he wanted to keep his scholarship because he was using his public figure as an athlete to make money. And they said, you can't do that under NCAA rules. Galvatron responded, said, disagree. It's not like a real sports athlete who would not get a contract if he blew out his knee. A kid not getting a gaming contract now does not preclude him from getting one later on when he's more mature. I think maybe he's disagreeing with something we said as opposed to what I said in the chat. And that's a valid point. I won't argue with that. But I don't know. As a parent, I'm not mad that this kid has a contract. I think you scout talent young, and as long as you make sure they're taken care of, as long as, like Max said, the guardian is okay with it, I think that this is not a bad move. If he's beating adults, let him do it. Let the kid play.
It certainly has wound up being a pretty interesting talking point, if nothing else.
Yeah, now one last thing real quick, and then we'll wrap unless Mac has something else to say. Galvatron said, I'd tell my kid to get an education first. I gotta address this. First and foremost, no one is saying that those things are mutually exclusive. The kid can still get an education while being on the esports team. There's child actors, like Max said. You don't think that those kids were going to school in the evenings or in the mornings before the show shot? The second thing I'll say in response to that is, what is an education, really? A traditional education results in no guarantees. A surgeon can break his wrist, you know? All types of things can happen that will make your traditional education worthless. So yes, it's the typical route, but I'm a big proponent of pursue your passion while you're young. As someone who does stand-up comedy, that's what I believe. Mac, anything else you want to say before we wrap up that topic?
No, I think we've said all that needs to be said. Well, now we turn to a crowdfunding project that's trying to get off of the ground. We call this Kick or Kickstart, and as with everything in Two Nerds in a Pod, we want those of you who are here with us live to weigh in on what you think. I am posting a link to this in the chat. We will discuss some of the ups, some of the downs, and we will say whether or not we think this should be kickstarted or kicked out of here at the end. So we are looking at Aeroheart. Aeroheart? I'm not 100% sure how it's meant to be said, but it comes from Down Under because they deal in Australian dollars. So it's gonna be pretty great. They are looking for 11,000, nearly $11,500 US converted to get this off of the ground. They currently have 29 days left to go. And if you like the look of this project, the minimum buy-in is $12 for a digital copy to be released estimated March 2022. So that gives you an idea of how far out we are with this Kickstarter project. I am not going to sugarcoat this. This is inspired by A Link to the Past, and it shows, and it's pretty, it's beautiful. I like a lot of the things that they're doing here. This would be the first offering from Pixel Heart Studio, and Samuel North, who's the founder and, you know, a big part of Pixel Heart Studio, is 25. So I have to admit, I'm a little bit surprised that A Link to the Past winds up being such a big inspiration for a 25-year-old. But that's just my silliness getting in the way. I love the look, I love the style, I love the feel. So what I will say that I don't love so much about it is how long we're waiting for the development. I feel like a lot of the sprites, a lot of the scenes are a lot moodier and, you know, dark in tone, where I feel like they should be brighter, you know, but that's just me. Mr. Nice Guy, what are your thoughts on this?
So I have a bunch of thoughts. First of all, like, I've never been, with all of the Kickstarters we've done in 169 episodes, including this one, I've never been so excited, but also skeptical. See, Galvatron hit the nail in the head. He said, somebody's going to get sued, because this is straight up A Link to the Past. Now, this is me talking. This is straight up A Link to the Past with a different character sprite. Like, I didn't realize how much A Link to the Past this was until I scrolled down and saw that the maps look exactly like A Link to the Past. And then I started watching the video and I was like, oh, the water, the ladders, the sprites of the enemies, like, it's straight up A Link to the Past. And I don't know if that's a bad thing, because A Link to the Past is great and I like what he's doing here. I like that it's $12 to get a copy, but I just don't like that it is such a tribute as opposed to being something new. Also, can I say this about Kickstarters in general, Mac? Let's get rid of the back it because you care tier, or the back it because you believe in it tier. Like, it's $8 to back it because you believe in it, when you could just pay $4 more and get the game. Who's doing that?
Well,
you know what I mean?
It's whatever amount you want for the pledging without a reward. It just, Kickstarter defaults to like 10 what units.
Okay,
which
fair.
10 Australian dollars winds up being about 8, you know, US dollars. But you could put anything in there. And that's just a Kickstarter wide. That's not something people are putting in on their Kickstarter. That's just something that Kickstarter leaves there as a, hey, pledge at any level type of a thing.
Can I say one more thing real quick?
Sure.
I was harsh, but this looks very cool. The other thing I wanted to say is the PlayStation 5 is out. It looks like this is releasing Switch, PS4, and other places. Like, just tell us that it's going to be on the PS5 as well. Like, don't just say it's on the PS4. Make it clear that you're going to put it on the next gen, especially when this is not releasing for another year and a half.
For another 2 years and a quarter, because it's not until March 2022. Oh, actually, well, I
so
guess
because it's almost 2021.
Yeah, it's almost 2020. That's fair.
So anyway, that's what I had to say.
Okay, so just a couple of things, sort of again, kind of against this strikes. I will say I don't think that they're going to be, they're likely to have too much in the way of legal troubles, because while there are plenty of similarities, I think the differences are enough that they're going to be okay. But that's very much a question of whether or not Nintendo Legal thinks that they're different enough to be okay and doesn't try something. And it's not like they've tried meritless suits, haven't tried meritless suits in the past. They absolutely have. But I think they'll probably be okay. That being said, though, we do have at least one thing that I very much have to throw out there, and they address it in their frequently asked questions for the thing. And it'll say, will this game have a demo/beta testing? And it says that, as this game is heavily story-driven, we are still contemplating whether a demo is needed or even a good idea due to spoiling the plot. We have numerous playtests scheduled by NDA subscribers, and for the public to have a spoiler-free demo, it would take a lot of time out of our development cycle in executing a new demo outside of the main game. So to deliver the game as quickly as possible to fans, we will most likely forego the creation of a separate public demo. And you know me, man, that's kind of a deal breaker for me, because there are a lot of things that you can build in game engines. There's a lot of stuff that you can do to make something look like it works, but just have it essentially be a tech demo and nothing more. If there's not a playable demo to go alongside your Kickstarter, it's my feeling that you're not ready for Kickstarter if you don't have something to show. And I know that that's kind of an onerous requirement. It's a high bar, and people are always, you know, there are so many people that are getting kicked because of that. But I especially, in a case of something like this, I want to see if you can, you know, bring the Link to the Past vibes. If that's what you're going for, can you deliver? And I can't know that without a playable demo, so, you know, gotta get a kick from me.
Someone says, looking at Mighty No. 9, mm-hmm. I think he's referencing the fact that Mighty No. 9 was such a huge tribute to Mega Man and ended up being a flop. I don't know if that's what Alex Mann is trying to say. Here's the last thing I'll say about this. A Link to the Past is arguably the best Zelda game ever made. And last year, I kickstarted a game called Hazelnut Bastille that was supposed to be a Link to the Past tribute, right? Same as this. Now this is a Link to the Past tribute. There are free Link to the Past tributes. There's already on the eShop another game, I can't remember the name of it right now, that's a Link to the Past tribute.
Can we ever have enough Link to the Past tributes?
I think we can have too many, and I think that we've reached that point, because the original game was perfection, in my opinion, as far as that genre. And then they did a Link Between Worlds, which was like an updated version of it for the handheld. I believe it was 3DS. Let's let that game go to bed. Let's let it go to rest, right? Let's stop making tributes to Link to the Past.
I disagree. Keep making tributes to Link to the Past. But that being said, I do say kick. Kick it out of here.
So as critical as I've been of this, for $12, a high quality Link to the Past on Switch, and we know that the Switch is already halfway through its life cycle, so it's still going to be around in a couple years, year and a half. Who knows what games we will have at that point? We may be Zelda hungry. I'm going to say Kickstart.
Okay.
$12 is very reasonably priced for this type of game.
And those of you who've chimed in, we've got a soft Kickstart from Spenis. Spenis is also not too worried about the plagiarization there.
Metzgirl said Kickstart so hard.
Yes, Metzgirl said Kickstart. Kickstart immediately. So
right now.
So yeah, looks like most people are against me on this one, but that's okay. We wish these guys the best. Here's to hoping that it gets funded, it gets made, and that it's everything we could have hoped for and more. But that's been Kick or Kickstart. And well, now the fun part of the show begins.
Let's do it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a segment we call Nerd Flex.
Woo-hoo.
A segment where you, the viewers, try to stump the hosts, and sometimes you actually succeed. Now, I know a couple people said they were getting those questions ready because they are anticipating trying to stump us pre-Christmas, Mac. Get those questions in the chat. We're going to try to get straight up three questions from the group this week. Nothing from the test bank. Alex Mann says he has one. I know Spenis probably has one about Pokemon. And if anyone else has one, go ahead and get that in, preferably multiple choice. I will read the first question that just came in, hot off the presses, from Alex Mann. Which film inspired the enemies in Nintendo's Metroid series? This is a great question. A. Star Wars. B. Galaxy of Terror. C. Predator. Or D. Alien.
Okay, so obviously, Metroid occurs in space, so that's a good thing for Star Wars. I've never heard of Galaxy of Terror. Predator is cool, but didn't happen in a jungle. And Alien, I mean, not only space, but also we've got those xenomorphs in there and lots of cool crawly stuff. I am inclined toward Alien, but I have to admit, I don't know.
I don't know either, but I'm pretty sure it's not Star Wars. That's just straight up too easy. And I think about the bad guys in Star Wars, or rather the enemies in Star Wars, and they just don't match up with Metroid. Alien has like creepy, like crawly stuff, like stuff with tentacles. You know, and so I lean towards that, just having played a lot of Metroid games. Additionally, a lot of the bosses in Metroid, at least some of them, are like big. I'm trying to think of how to describe them. Like,
paint us like a alien, word picture.
Alien-like. Almost like alien-like. So I'm going to go with Alien as well.
Excellent. Well, Alien, we've locked it in. Alex Mann has quickly responded with D, Alien. The Metroid team was most influenced by the film's creature designer, H.R. Geiger. Excellent. Nice. Dude, we've locked in one. Spenis' question is, in Pokemon Gold and Silver, there are 16 gym leaders that featured a type of Pokemon except one. Which type was not featured by a gym leader? Was it A, Dragon, B, Ghost, C, Dark, or D, Ground? So, wow, this is a good one, because
I don't even understand the question. So, 16 gym leaders that featured... Oh, that were, I see what he's saying.
Yeah,
okay.
A type of Pokemon, a Pokemon type. They had that theme going.
Got it.
I seem to recall a Dark one.
Pokemon Gold and Silver. Like, here's the thing. Pokemon is a blur to me. I've dabbled in it, and I've played a lot of different Pokemon games, but not to the point that I would remember Red and Blue versus Gold and Silver versus Sapphire, right? I don't remember them. So, Mac, I'm leaning on you.
Real quick, Spenis has put out a clarification. Fairy, in this case, does not count, as Gen 2 did not feature Fairy as a separate Pokemon type. The question more regards Generations 1 and 2 pre-Blue taking over the gym. So, but that being said, if we're talking about Pokemon Gold and Silver, you could go back to the previous region of Pokemon. You could go back to like Pallet Town and Cerulean City and Celadon and everything. And in that, so we can basically say that that's where we're getting the 8 and the 8, right? The 16 gym leaders. And so a type of Pokemon except for one. I still feel like Dark is the one that I can't think of being featured, but I'm pretty sure I'm wrong on this.
Do you think there was a ghost gym?
There was a ghost gym, or was it a psychic? There was a psychic gym in Red and Blue, right? And so while there wasn't exactly a ghost gym, I feel like we got that in Gold and Silver.
All right, well, let's go with Dark then. I'm following you on this.
However, you lean towards Ghost. Let's go with Ghost on this one, because to be fair, Dark was a new type in Gold and Silver, so I feel like they would want to show it off. You know what I mean? So let's go with Ghost, because I think your confidence in Ghost is better than my confidence in that. Watch it be something that was on neither of our radar. Watch it be Ground.
There it is from Spinach.
Dark is the correct Mac answer. Dang.
You
it
were right, dude. You were right.
Okay.
I shouldn't have questioned you.
Well, oh well. Hey, you win some, you lose some. There have been plenty of times where I've been confident about something and you've gone my way and it's turned out wrong. So Kit has come with a multiple choice on this one. So let's do it. Kit, you got it. So the question is now, what is Lit RPG? A, novelizations of video games. B, novelizations of tabletop role-playing games. C, novels featuring games as a primary part of the plot, often using game mechanics. Or D, novels where the characters role-play as other characters. Interesting. I'm inclined towards saying D, novels where the characters role play as other characters, because that seems meta and fun.
It does, but it almost seems too deep. But I'm not going to question you this time.
No, you questioned me last time. No, you should question me.
So I don't feel like it's going to be a novelization of tabletop role playing games.
Okay, so we're striking B. Novelizations of video games would make this a video game related question. So there is some weight there for A. And novels featuring games as a primary part of the plot, often using game mechanics. I don't know. That seems a pretty thinly sliced genre. You know what I mean?
Yeah, on second thought, I'm going to go with, I think, D. I think you're right. D? It seems like it's the most logical. Yeah.
Okay. And watch, it's going to be A. But we are
going. I believe
in
you.
We're going with D, novels where the characters role play as other characters. This just shows how up we are on our literary genres.
What is the answer, Kit? Let us know in the chat.
It is C.
Dang. We went 1-for-3 this week. That's okay.
Kit, we're going to move on to the last segment, but I am curious to hear some examples of lit RPG that we might have heard of before.
That we should read. Yeah.
Yeah, or a recommendation if you want to save it till what we've been watching, what we've been playing, because that's the recommendation segment. well, all right, let's move on to our last segment. Thanks for participating. We call this last little bit Legalese. I am not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast, and obviously there's so much law going on, and video games are at the heart of a lot of this, so it's important to talk about it. For starters, we have had multiple shows over the past year or so talking about both the CASE Act, which I've mentioned before, as well as the Protecting Lawful Streaming bill that was recently proposed. Last episode, we discussed how the Protecting Lawful Streaming was not as bad as people were making it out to be. And it still is not as bad as people are making it out to be. Also, with the CASE Act, it is as bad as people are making it out to be. And would it surprise you to hear, Mr. Nice Guy, that both the CASE Act and the Protecting Lawful Streaming were both passed yesterday in the whole funding bill for the government in the United States.
Interesting.
No. Would it surprise you?
Would it surprise me?
Yes.
I'm trying to think. No, probably not.
Yeah, no. Didn't surprise me either.
Probably slid in there.
True. So there's good things, there's bad things. We've been on about that ad nauseum. Instead, we're going to move on to what I think is important, still somewhat interesting, and the decision's not yet final on this one. That would be Zajonic v. Electronic Arts. In this, Zajonic and others are suing for deceptive practices and false advertising on account of their claim that in EA's sports titles, that EA adjusts the difficulty of the sports games to try and push the gamer into paying for player packs in order to advance. Now, it's worth noting that if you're like, I don't know, do you think EA would do that? EA does have a patent number US 2017-02-59177-A1, for an AI-based skill level adjustment for modifying game content expressly for the use of increasing the difficulty of a video game on the fly. So it's not like there's no reason to be suspicious that EA would do something like that, which is exactly what these people are claiming. They're claiming that it's happened, that without telling the player, EA is, quote, utilizing one or more artificial intelligence technologies that adjusts game difficulty dynamically, ellipses, because we move a little bit farther, a couple sentences slider, to adaptively change the difficulty of matches and influence or even dictate the outcomes, end quote. So if true, that's not great. And it seems to be where the deceptive practices bit comes into play. But what about the false advertising part? Because they're suing for deceptive practices and false advertising. Where's the false advertising, I hear you say, Mr. Nice Guy? I hear you cry. Well, it's rooted in the same grievance, you see, but with a little bit of flair. As their claim here, EA describes itself as having, quote, unrivaled authenticity, or the most authentic representation. But, quote, since difficulty adjusting mechanisms make gamers believe their teams are less skilled than they actually are, leading them to purchase additional player packs in hopes of receiving better players and being more competitive, end quote. Making these claims of authenticity that apparently EA is making about their game false advertising. Because good players and good teams aren't so much that way because of fidelity to reality or authenticity, but just because of the whims of a program. I could go on about this one, but I will say instead that they are trying to get certified as a class action suit, but it won't be getting underway till the beginning of next year. As always, I will try and keep you updated on what's going on with these as they're still developing. I'm not especially hopeful for this one. It seems very much like a Hail Mary, especially on the false advertising. Deceptive practices, that seems stronger. False advertising, not so much. But EA, the company you love to hate, and I certainly love to hate, thank you for putting up with, once again, another installment in Mac rants against EA, but they know what they did. That's been Legalese.
Always informative, always good. It is fun. Well, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in to Two Nerds in a Pod, episode number 169. Y'all are the best viewers on Twitch. Have a fantastic holiday season. Merry Christmas. Be excellent to each other. Stay safe and wear a mask. We'll catch y'all next week. Same bat place, same bat time, same bat rhymes. Keep it nerdy, y'all.
See ya.